The last two verses of the first chapter of Ephesus, which we've been studying, as a sort of a foundation on which to base what I have to say today. God has placed everything under the power of Christ and has set him up as head of everything for the church. That's a capital C, and it doesn't refer to denomination, but to the church of the living God. And it isn't to the churches, but to the church. For the church is his body, and in that body lives fully the one who fills the whole wide universe. And it seems to me that any action that we take, whether as Lutherans or Roman Catholics or any other denomination within the Christian orbit, we need to keep in mind that we are members of the body of Christ. It hasn't always been acknowledged that that's true, and there are still some today who will not acknowledge it. But we are all members of the body of Christ, and we must keep that in mind. In the first presentation that I made, for those of you who have been to all three, you remember that we tried to lay somewhat of a foundation in terms of the kind of a society in which we live, and built particularly on the idea of how so many of our forebears, as Lutherans, for example, and not only Lutherans, but Roman Catholics and other denominations as well, were an immigrant people and came over here, and the first concern was that of survival. And then we were concerned after that about status, after we no longer need to worry too terribly much about survival, and that's the situation today. And then we are concerned about status, what do people think about us, and so forth. But the highest of these three levels of existence is the level of significance. And I think it is fair to say that the younger generation has turned our eyes in this direction as a class now, more than maybe we who are older or middle-aged people. We still have some of the hang-ups. Ruth and I have four children and 13 grandchildren, so we have a liberal education in our old age. And I mean that sincerely, because our grandchildren teach us much as our children prior to that have taught us a great deal. And one of the things that we have been both thrilled and pleased with has been this sense of their having been concerned about the significance of life. I remember when Kemp was a kid, he'd say, "Pop, what do you think I ought to be in life?" And I said, "Well, that's up to you to make that decision." "Well, don't you care what I am?" "Oh," I said, "I care very much." "Whatever you are, be a faithful child of Christ, faithful, loyal supporter of the church, but you can do that no matter what you are." He went through the period, "Oh, boys, do you want to be a fireman?" or, you know, that sort of thing. And then finally he decided that he was going to be a teacher, and he trained himself to be a teacher, became a teacher, got married, and taught for a couple of years, and all of a sudden decided that God had laid his hand on his shoulder to do something else, to go into the ministry. Ruth and I were not the first to find that out. Others did. But he was concerned both in teaching and in the ministry to make of his life, out of his life, a significance that would make a contribution to the world that had given him so much, and so forth. And I think that same thing is true. We notice our grandchildren are going through the same thing, struggling with it. And they're all different, and all very different. Our oldest grandson has finished a part of a year at the University of California at Berkeley. He now is toying with the idea that maybe he ought to stay out a year and work and all of that sort of thing. Really what that is, basically, he doesn't know what to do with his life. And he's got to deal with that problem. And if we're wise and his parents are wise, we will stay out of that. Give him a sense of our support, but making him realize that he's a member of the church and a member of a family that cares very much, both instances. So these are the things that we were talking about. And then we talked about the Christian in community, and part of that community was the Christian community, and part of that community was the religious community, that is, community of other religious, living as we do in a pluralistic society. And what do we do then when we get together with representatives of other faiths? How can we work together? It occurred to me that one of the things I could have mentioned in connection with our interreligious council in Los Angeles is that you really are not working together effectively unless two things can happen. First, you can criticize your partner in another religion and do it with a sense of freedom, and you can kid him. If you can't do those two things, you really don't have a base on which to proceed. We have in our group and in our board I can never pronounce the names of the Sikh Dharma people. They adopt new names when they become members of that sect, and they're all long, you know, Sing this and Sing that, and all kinds of names. We have an attorney there. Phil Hoskins is his name. He was baptized in that name, but now that he's become a Sikh Dharma member, he has sent a letter to all his friends saying what his new name is. And whenever I meet him, I say, Phil, I can't say what that name of yours is. Can't I just call you Phil? And when you get to this point, that's fine. Well, the leader of that group is an Indian from India, huge person, and Yogi. We all call him Yogi. That's part of his name. And you got the rest of it. I can never Yogi Bhajan. And then there's more. But we call him Yogi, and he's as bad as I am. He's been vaccinated with a phonograph needle, and he doesn't know when to stop talking, especially in a group. And so my Methodist and Presbyterian and Episcopal friends say to me, Sager, can you find any way to shut him up? Well, now, if you can say to him, as I had to do one time, Yogi, you've talked so much, let somebody else talk, then you're on a level when you can begin to talk about things that are meaningful. So, and then you can begin to say, you know, what you've got to say is fine, but we've got something to say too. You need to listen for a while. And to do this in what we call Christian love, and the Sikh Dharma would call it something else, but it would be the same thing, then you get to the point where you can exchange those values. So we talked about some of those things. And now today I want to talk about the Lutheran in community. A lot of times people use the term ecumenical when they say that, well, we get together ecumenically as Lutherans. And they use the term ecumenical to mean three synodical bodies. And that's a total misuse of the term from my point of view. That's inter-Lutheran. It's not ecumenical. Ecumenical in my vocabulary is limited to the Christian world. When Protestants, Catholics, and Orthodox get together, that's ecumenical. And if it goes beyond to include Jews and Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims and all the rest, that's interfaith or interreligious, as the case may be. And that's the way I'm going to be using the terms this morning. Now, specifically with regard to Lutherans, 100 years ago, there were more Lutherans in America than Heinz has pickles, more different brands of Lutherans. Literally, everybody that came over almost organized a church. And there are books written, and I'm not going to review them, though they are available, that give the history of the development of the Lutheran churches in America. And it's a fantastic pattern that will be bewildering to see all of these very many groups got together to form this small body, and many more this small body, and many more this small body. And then the next level, these smaller bodies got together. But there were certain reasons for that occurring, as most of you know. It wasn't primarily theological, although there were differences of opinion between those who were pietistic and those who were more, what one could call orthodox, conservative. The pietistic people today would be called charismatic. They're similar, but not identical. But you had those differences. For example, the background that I'm most familiar with, because my forebears came from Sweden, was that we had a state church of Sweden that grew out of a Reformation that was never a true Reformation. It, as a matter of fact, Dr. Bergenhoff has written a book called The Swedish Transformation. It's a transformation from Roman Catholic to Lutheran, and it didn't go through the Reformation, the reforming process that the Lutheran churches in Germany did under Luther's leadership and Melanchthon and the others. So it's somewhat a different background. That's why in the Church of Sweden there are many historic things that carry on, historic vestments, the historic episcopacy, and so forth. All of this carry on. But then it's pretty well documented that the Church of Sweden got to be pretty dead and self-centered during one period of its life. And when it did, God raised up a group of people that were warm-hearted pietists, or charismatics, if you please. And the immigration was largely from that group of people. But among them also were others who were just as conservative and quote-unquote old-fashioned as the Church of Sweden. So you had, when the Augustana Church was formed here, all of this heritage. Now, and part of it was linguistic. Most of it was not theological, but part of it was linguistic. And I think that if we could understand that, if we were suddenly to be thrown into China or Korea or any place where strange languages are spoken, strange to our ears, we wouldn't feel very good about worshiping in Chinese if we didn't understand a single thing about it. We'd want to worship in the language that was native to us, even when languages are similar. I can't fluently speak Swedish. I remember one time when I came back from the seminary, my dad wanted me to do the Swedish liturgy for Christmas morning service. And mother said, "Oh, don't impose that upon the people. He can't speak Swedish." Dad said, "Oh, I think he can." So he gave me the book and said to read. You know, well, I got along fine in the liturgy, but when it came to reading the scriptures, especially the Old Testament, I floundered all over the place. And so Dad said finally, very quietly, "Well, maybe I better do it." Now, it wasn't unnatural to me, but I can read Swedish and Norwegian and Danish and get the sense out of it. I can't speak any of it, but I can get the sense out of it. And Finnish is a little bit difficult. We have Finnish congregations, and I visited those Finnish congregations. Ruth and I can sing the songs because the melodies are the same. But one nice thing about the Finnish language, the words are all about that long, but you pronounce every syllable. There are no silent syllables like we have in our language. So you can really sing along if somebody next to you sings and you can lean a little bit. That it works out that way, but don't really understand it. So this was kind of the background that caused many of the Lutheran churches to go this direction. Well, then, by 1962, and I use that date because the LCA, the body with which I am affiliated, was the last of the three major bodies to come into being. The ALC had come into being 2 or 4 years ahead of that, whatever it was. Anybody tell me offhand? I can't remember. But it was ahead of that anyway by a couple of years. Although I might say parenthetically or in a footnote, it took the groups that made the ALC 4 years longer. The process of merger took 10 years, whereas in the LCA it took 6 years, 4 years less. And the reasons were twofold. Number one, we began with the conviction we were all Lutherans, and the bodies forming the ALC didn't. They had to have 2 or 3 years that they made certain statements that the other would have to agree to. But we didn't go through that monkey business. And the second was, we learned from the mistakes that they had made. Now, and the reason I mention this is not to downgrade the ALC. This is just the progress in human relations. But if it took that merger 10 years and it took us 6 years, it's entirely conceivable that when ALC and LCA and maybe part of Missouri merge, it ought to be able to be done in no more than 4 years. I think you may think that's a long time, but it really isn't a long time when you think of all that has to be worked out, and I'll have a bit more to say about that. Well, anyway, we had it then by 1862, three major bodies, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, the American Lutheran Church, LCMS is the words we'll use, or the letters we'll use for Missouri Synod, the ALC is the American Lutheran Church, and the LCA is the Lutheran Church in America. Now, we have three, all the way down from 57 varieties to three in about 100 years. That's progress. The general overall thrust is one of merger, although slow and sometimes painful. Now, what about the picture today? 10 years after the LCA has merged, 12 or 14 years after the ALC has merged, and the Missouri Synod merger date, I don't recall. It's much earlier than that. Actually, this is called the Synodical Conference, and so forth. Well, anyway, what's the picture today? Dr. Fry used to say, he was our president, first president of the LCA, and a brilliant person, one of God's great leaders in this past century. He used to say, rather cynically, that the Lutheran churches would merge 50 years after it would do any good. And I rather bristled at that statement, because I thought, it surely can't be true. Well, that was said maybe 15 years ago, and we're getting an awful lot closer to the 50 than we were at that time. What's the picture in Lutheranism today? The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is going through terrible tragedy and heartbreak, and some of you are members of that body who are here. And let me say to you that none of the other Lutheran bodies rejoice over your tragedy, just the reverse, because it hurts all of us. I recall when the difficulty at St. Louis in the seminary broke many years ago, and I happened to be, as I still am, a member of the Methodist Seminary, the School of Theology at Claremont, which is a Methodist seminary, and I'm a member of the board, have been for 20 years of that Methodist seminary. I used to tell Bishop Kennedy I'm a better board member than he is. I go to more of the meetings of his seminary board than he did. He used to hate to do that. But Tom Trotter, who was the academic dean at that time at Claremont, was the chairman of the committee that investigated the LCMS program when Ebgen, or whatever his name was kicked out because of, for various reasons we don't need to go into. And Tom said to me, "Sager, what's the matter with you Lutherans?" I said, "What are you talking about?" And then he mentioned, and I knew about the problem, but that's it. I said, "Well, we're not members of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod." And he chuckled and he said, "I know that, but it is tragic." And I said, "Yes, and it will affect all of us." So the tragedy does affect all of us. And let me say here, I don't think anybody, a member of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, ought to feel that they are so unique in terms of having differences of opinion and have the opinion that the other two Lutheran bodies don't have differences of opinion. There is as much difference of opinion within the Lutheran Church bodies as there is among them. You see, and for example, there are ultra-conservatives in LCA, there are ultra-conservatives in ALC, and there are ultra-conservatives in Missouri. I suppose one would think the natural way to go at that would be that then those three groups within each church ought to break off and merge, and that'd be tragic. Or if the middle grounders are the more open-minded liberals were to do it. Because we need the whole business in our Lutheran church. So the picture is fuzzy. The LCMS in tragedy. I don't see any other thing other than that the Missouri Synod is going to split off. It's going to split. And it's tragic. It's dividing congregations. It's dividing families. That's the tragedy of it. Sons who are students at Seminex have as candidates for the ministry, the seminary in exile, and their fathers who are ministers, you know, poles apart. That's tragic. You can't do anything but pray that God might somehow bring sanity and healing into that situation. When Dr. Jack Preuss, the president of the Missouri Synod, spoke at our convention in Boston about a month ago, he said he chastised the LCA because 2 years prior to that we had taken a rather strong stand in complimenting those forces within Missouri that wanted to remain, as we saw it, closer to the freedom of the gospel. And his chastisement was that we really, well, he put it in polite words, but the essence of it was, you didn't know what you're talking about, brothers and sisters. That was received with rather less than applause, I can assure you. But anyway, he said in his presentation, only about a dozen congregations are going to leave Missouri. I think that is, you know, that's just a hope that isn't going to materialize. I don't know how many congregations are going to leave, but I think it would be a couple hundred at least that will leave, would be my feeling. 200 or 300, maybe more. That's going to be tragic, but that's what's going to happen. And I can share just one illustration so you know where I stand. One lady called me over the phone in Los Angeles about a year ago, and she said that, Dr. Segerhammer, you don't know me, and she did not give me her name. I wouldn't have known her if she had. But she said, I'm a member of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. I heard you speak about 4 years ago, and you struck me as one who was a person of integrity, and so I want to ask you a question. She said, I am a member of a Missouri Synod congregation which is torn apart by the struggle within Missouri. She said, there's a group that are in favor of Elam, Evangelical Lutherans in Mission, and then there are those who are faithful to the Lutheran Church at the Missouri Synod as it now exists. She said, I don't know what it's all about. Our pastor has just been fired by the group that's loyal to the Missouri Synod. He's a young man with a wife and 2 children. The congregation was about 700 or 800 families. And she said, 200 families of us think that's an unchristian way to treat our minister, and we're pulling out. We're not pulling out because of Elam. We're pulling out because he was treated in an unchristian manner. See how confused this whole thing can get. I'd like to know what the Elam program is all about. And I said, well, ma'am, in fairness, I've got to tell you first where I stand. I do not support Dr. Preuss's position. I wouldn't trust that position any farther than I can throw a piano. And I think that John Tejan, who is the president of the seminary, is a prince in the kingdom of God. I support the Elam position. So you've got to know that when I give you my response, or it wouldn't be fair. And she said, all right, that's, I understand. And so we talked, I suppose, 45 minutes. Among other things I said was, are you calling this young man to be your pastor? This is a group that has pulled away. She said, we have issued the call. He hasn't accepted it yet. And I don't know what will happen. I said, do you have a place to worship? Yes, she said, we do. I said, I ask that because when our pastors and church members in the Lutheran Church in America ask me what stance we should take, my advice is, if you have a sister Lutheran church, Missouri Synod congregation in your area which is having difficulty and a group pulls away, don't try to get them to join your church and merge. That'd be a tragic mistake. But offer them the use of your facilities so they can maintain their connections with either the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, or with the Elam group, as the case may be. Don't try to be like a carrion group of birds that would come down and eat off of the carcass of something. Be that way. So I said, I wanted to be sure you had a place to meet. Well, she said, that's really not the problem. And she went on, and her heart, you know, you could just tell that her heart was breaking over this thing. And I think this, for me, epitomizes the very depth of the struggle that was present. And then another example that may sharpen it up too. About a year ago in February, when I was still in the office of president of our synod, annually the presidents and bishops of the 3 major Lutheran bodies get together for a conference. Tom Spitz was the chairman of LACUSA, which is the group through which all 3 bodies work. and in practical workings and so forth, studies and so on. And Tom had arranged, we met in Chicago in one of the big hotels, and he had arranged that for a certain number of the sessions, we were to meet around tables that would hold six people. And then he seated us so that at every table we had two LCA presidents, two ALC bishops, and two Missouri, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod presidents, one of whom was an Elam supporter and one who was sympathetic with Preuss. So that at every one of the tables, and we were about 100 altogether, so at every one of the tables, all of those viewpoints were represented. And to say the least, it was an eye-opening and very difficult discussion. Most of the conversation carried on between the two presidents from Missouri Synod. And the rest of us were only almost observers, except to ask to raise certain questions. So this is kind of the picture of the way Missouri Synod is. Ruth and I visited a Missouri Synod church I believe it was Pasadena, someplace there, when Tom Spitz, prior to the Anaheim Convention, was the speaker. And someone raised the question as to what would happen with the Elam group at Anaheim, if depending upon what happened at Anaheim. His response was, "We will never leave the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, but we will probably be thrown out. And if we are, then," he said, "we will organize as a church, but we will not exist very long, because we think we will become the catalyst that will bring ALC and LCA together." And that may very well be what will happen. If it would, it would be a kind of interesting thing, because ALC used to occupy that position. You know, they'd say, the most liberal one is LCA, the most conservative is Missouri Synod, and ALC is in the middle, and we'll bring you all together. and maybe that would have been possible too, but it didn't occur. Anyway, that's the LCMS tragic position. Now, what about the ALC? In my estimation, the death of Kent Knudsen was a real tragedy. Kent Knudsen, if he had lived, and I have real spiritual problems at this point, but if Kent Knudsen had lived, we would have been, in my estimation, very close to merger today. I knew him well, and we worked well together. He and Dr. Marshall, our president, they thought alike. And almost like extrasensory perception. It was just something else. And then for an unknown reason, God took him. And this is the part that bothers me, you see. I don't understand that. I don't criticize God. He's much wiser than any of us or all of us put together. But you wonder why. What's God trying to say to us in this kind of a situation? Jack Preuss still lives, who is, from the point of view of many, wrecking the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And Kent Knudsen, who is the solace of Lutheranism, is taken away. What's God trying to say? And I'm very, very childlike at that point. I try to sense what God is trying to say in these kinds of movements. What's happened since that time reminds me of, was it Winston Churchill who said he didn't become prime minister to preside over the dissolution of Her Majesty's empire? And I kind of think that's the position that Dave Preuss has taken, president of ALC, and understandably so. You know, he had to have time to get his feet on the ground as the president of a new church. There are no schools to train bishops or district presidents or church presidents. None. And when you are thrown into that responsibility, you sink or swim. And if you're going to swim, you've got to have some breathing room. And Dave has had to have that breathing room. So the position that he has taken, it seems to me, is kind of, from my point of view, I'm disappointed, because he has put the brakes on with regard to Lutheran unity, in the sense that we don't need to spend extra time in organizational fol-de-rol. What we need to do now is to get on to the business of the kingdom. And that sounds great. And it's a great thing where Lutherans are strong. But where Lutherans are weak, like we are out here on the coast, it was a kind of a death knell. He's not opposed to Lutheran unity. I want you to understand that. But he feels we ought to work together in certain areas, like we are working together in campus ministry. We are working together in parish education. We're working together in the hymnal thing. We're working together in a lot of other things like this. And that's good. And he feels we should continue in that. And I think we should continue in that, but I think it ought to be more than that. But what about my own body, then, the Lutheran Church in America? And as I see it, the Lutheran Church in America is kind of a cross between champing at the bit, wanting Lutheran merger at almost any cost, and on the other hand, disillusionment with the whole process of merger. I don't know whether Carol would agree with me on that, but I think that's where LCA is. And I think it's kind of a dangerous position to be in, where you say, well, you know, if you can't go on with it, let's forget the whole business. I think that's unfortunate. And here we are where the times demand a strong Christian witness. And here we are minding the store in our own situation and seemingly satisfied to do just that. Now, it was in that kind of a context that 2 years ago I proposed to our Pacific Southwest Synod, and for the benefit of those of you who may not be Lutheran or LCA, the Pacific Southwest Synod comprises the states of California, Arizona, Nevada, Hawaii, and Utah, those five states. And I proposed to our convention that we organize a regional Lutheran church. And I said at the very beginning that my purpose to do this was not to hopefully not to necessarily start an indigenous Lutheran church on the West Coast that just multiplied the number of Lutheran bodies that we have, but hopefully to use this as a matter of getting off the dime in terms of total Lutheran unity. Maybe it was one way that hadn't been tried. And our Synod Convention adopted it unanimously, and we extended the invitation to the other Lutheran bodies on the coast. At that convention, Arnie Mickelson, the secretary of the ALC, a very wonderful layperson, was present, and he said, Sager, I've got another idea. Why don't we form sectional Lutheran churches, and where the Lutheran church, and there'd be the strongest Lutheran church in that area, like if ALC is strongest in the Middle West, then the Middle West becomes ALC. And the Lutheran church in America is strongest on the East Coast. Why doesn't everybody get together on the East Coast? And that leaves the West Coast out here, you know, in limbo. Because nobody is strongest out here. Missouri Synod actually is the largest. And I think ALC in Southern California, no ALC in Southern, in our area, is larger than we are in that area. I don't know what the relative sizes are up here, but I think it's about the same. But what would it be then? Would Missouri be satisfied only to take the West Coast? God forbid. They got strength. So, you know, I didn't think that was much of an idea, but he was proposing that. And what I think it does show, however, is that, you know, there is interest in getting off the dime so that we don't just sort of stagnate. Now, I'd like to reiterate what I've suggested several times, that in the Middle West, where many of you come from, you don't need each other. The LCA doesn't need the ALC or Missouri Synod. You're strong enough to do things yourself. Man, in South Dakota, the ALC not only controls the church situation, but the state situation. You know, you can elect anybody you want to for governors. If you stick together, you've got enough people to do this.
Interesting enough, we got the law change that would have put Paul in jail for henceforth the gospel is defined by the church, not the state.
Oh, great. Yeah, and the Lutheran Church, the ALC probably spearheaded that and did it. So this is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, we did it right from here. I got Peter Rocker to do it.
Yeah, but it was, you know, you had the votes in the ALC to do it. It's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. For example, our Red River Valley Synod has about 150 congregations, and I think your comparable district that includes that area has about 500 or 600. There were 17 instances right after our merger where we put ALC and LCA congregations together, 17 of them. One became LCA, 16 became ALC. See, and I'm not saying that's bad, I'm merely saying that shows the relative strength. So ALC doesn't need anybody in the Middle West. We don't need anybody in the East. You know, we're lousy with Lutherans. Like Fry used to say with Pennsylvania, the Lutherans are densest in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvanians didn't like that. But, I don't need to go into that. You know what it is. But it's different on the coast. I saw a map not too long ago in California where 6% of the people claimed, 6% of the people of California claimed to be Protestant. 6%. I mean, claimed to be church members. 6%. We operate on the basis that we have 4% Lutherans in California. 4%. And that's divided among all of the Lutheran bodies. And over half of those don't belong to any church. Half of that 4%. So you see, when you're getting down in that kind of a situation, you don't wield much of a big stick. Either in ecumenical circles in the church or in political circles anyplace. That's why it's an amazing thing that from somebody like myself who was president of a relatively small synod, we had 255 congregations and 450 ministers, but only about 125,000 baptized souls. That's a small church body spread over five states. The Methodists had five times that many in Southern California, you know, alone. And it's just unbelievable that someone leading a body as small as that could be listened to with such respect, as I think I'd have to say I was listened to both in ecumenical and interreligious circles, maybe even more so than in inter-Lutheran circles. And I think that what that says is not to enhance me as a leader, but it says that the churches and the other religious bodies want the Lutheran church to make its input. I remember many years ago when I was pastor in a Colorado town, Longmont, Colorado, we always called the Swedes, our baseball team was called the Swedes, although we had 16 different nationalities that belonged to the church. The other 15 didn't seem to mind it for some reason or other to be called Swedes. But when we dedicated our new church building, Mr. Landon, who was the mayor of the city, was a Congregationalist, was asked to give a greeting. And he made this statement, which I have never forgotten, and I think he was prophetic in it. He said he was glad to see that the Lutherans were growing. And then he said, "You have never accepted the responsibility in this community that the community had a right to expect you would." And he was right. It was just tragic. I've done more on an interreligious and civic level in Los Angeles, the big city, than I did when we lived in Longmont, Colorado, a small town of about 15,000 people. We just didn't do our stuff. We were aware of our smallness. We had a small ELC church, a smaller ALC church, this is before any of the mergers, and a small LCMS church, and our own, four Lutheran churches, all of them struggling for life. And that's, of course, been the history all along the place. Well, what's the progress so far? I'm sorry to get carried away with this end of it, and I want to wrap this part of it up rather quickly because I want to try to respond to some of your questions. When we issued this invitation to the church presidents to come and talk over this matter, all seven of the synods or districts involved in this area responded, every one of them. I think that's pretty remarkable. And it was right at the height of the LCMS tragedy. So we felt, all six of us, six of the seven felt, maybe the wisest thing to do was to let Paul Jacobs, who was one of the eight that was ultimately going to be kicked out, bear his soul among his peers who could understand and be sympathetic, and there was no political involvement. You know, why just let him pour out. And for an hour he did. And we listened. And I think that was therapeutic as far as he was concerned. And then we decided how we were going to operate. We would meet always in San Francisco because that was travel-wise about the same distance from the Portland-Seattle area or the Los Angeles area or the Denver area, which interestingly enough, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod president, Wally Myers, who's also one of the eight that was kicked out, or disciplined, I guess is a better way to say it, came. And so did Frank Hegland, who was the LCA minister, president. The ALC bishop couldn't come that particular time, but has since taken part. So we were seven bodies, districts and synods. The next thing we did was to invite staffs to come together and then to produce a certain amount of graphs and statistics to show who we were, where we operated, how many churches we had, what we had, like seminaries, colleges, outdoor ministries, you know, all of this, social ministry agencies and so forth. So we see what we have. And then we invited lay representatives to come. And the lay representatives were amazed at the very wonderful rapport between the seven presidents or bishops. And it was very, really, it always has been and still continues to be. And we have within that group a rather interesting mix, because you have Paul Jacobs, Emil Jakes from up here, and Wally Myers, all three, they're three of the eight that are being disciplined. And then Arnie Kuntz. Now, Arnie Kuntz is the president of Missouri Synod in my part of the city, the Synod, in the L.A. area, Southern California, Southern Nevada, and Arizona. Arnie is the one who was appointed by Jack Preuss to head the committee to try to ameliorate the difficulties in Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. So you can see what his position was. He's a very close personal friend of Paul Jacobs, but he didn't share his viewpoint. I remember at the meeting of these 100 bishops that I told you about earlier, I said to Arnie, "How you get along with your God-forsaken committee?" And he said, "Well, I'm not sure that it's God-forsaken, but," he said, "the Lord has created me with a lot of patience, and he's surely using it." And about 8 months later, I asked him the same question, and got an even more tragic response. But anyway, we seven got together, and among other things that was done was to elect Paul Carlson, Dr. Paul Carlson, who teaches at Washington University, an LCA layman up north here, to be a secretary for the group, and to conduct, to write a sort of a brochure that could be distributed to all the pastors and congregations in the area that we covered. And out of that has come someone who is expert in the field to help to devise a questionnaire so that, you know, it would be an honest questionnaire, wouldn't be prejudiced one way or the other. And we took a study on attitudes towards the Lutheran Church, regional Lutheran Church, and all the other things. And that's been a fascinating thing. And your pastor probably has a copy of that report. You could get it from him. And then at one time, and I could not attend this meeting, unfortunately, we were overseas, but they invited all three of the national presidents to be at one of the meetings, and they all came. I think in 1948, we had an all-Lutheran convention in San Francisco, and that was before any of the mergers. And eight Lutheran bodies had simultaneous conventions. And then we had one general business session on Thursday afternoon, and all of the evening services were held together. And every national president was there. And I think he was there to stop merger on the West Coast. I've written this in national magazines, and nobody's denied it. When we proposed the regional church in my synod a couple of years ago, no national president responded. I didn't know what Bob would think about it, and so I didn't ask him whether I should do this or shouldn't do it. I decided to do it, and then after I had put it in my report and had announced that I would call him or I would write to have talked to him and then get his position, I felt it would be unfair to him if I were to ask him his advice at this point, because if he'd said no and I went ahead anyway, that put him in a bad position, and if he'd said yes, that would put him in a bad position with maybe his fellow presidents on the national level. Unfortunately, when I did talk to him, after it was a fait accompli, then he he said, well, I think that was the right thing to do. So I felt pretty good about that. Well, in 1976, there was a joint convention of here in the Pacific Northwest, and I understand that went very well. Maybe by 1980, we can have a joint convention in San Francisco of all the Lutheran bodies in both the Pacific Northwest and Pacific Southwest. And I'd like to close about, and I see I've gone again almost over my time, but we got about 10 minutes left. Around what could we coalesce as West Coast Lutherans if we were to have a regional church? Now, obviously, we could coalesce, we will coalesce around word and sacraments, the proclamation of Christ. But maybe we're a little afraid of that. Do you remember the text for the 15th Sunday after Pentecost in the proclamation series, which we're, most of us are using, took its gospel text from the Gospel of St. John, the 6th chapter. And that was the chapter, you remember, where Jesus said, unless you eat the body of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you are not really living at all. And there was some more that was said. And then this comment, Jesus said all these things while teaching in the synagogue at Capernaum. And many of his disciples heard him say these things and commented, this is a hard teaching indeed. Who could accept that? I think the basic problem that he raised was that God is too close. Both Norstad and Hinderle have been talking about this too, about being God's being human. We don't have too much problem with the divinity of God, of Christ, but we have a lot of problem with the humanity of Christ, this whole problem. And that's what I think is involved in here. And they're saying, no, wait a minute, we don't want a God we can be that close. We want someone up there that we can worship at a distance. Tonight, is today Wednesday? Yeah, tonight at Vespers, I'm going to lead a hymn sing. And one of the hymns that I'm going to have us sing is number 480, which is set to a little Irish melody, but it is perfect theology in terms of immanence and transcendence. You know, God is immanent, closer to me than breathing and nearer than hands and feet, but also transcendent, so far away that we are awestruck by his tremendousness. You know, and then it puts these two together in that hymn. Our problem is not with the transcendence. Our problem is with the immanence of God. But that's where we have, and so, you know, when God says we're one and we aren't one, we don't want God around. No, we aren't one. So let's sneak over in a corner kind of thing. Well, what could we do together if we worked as Lutherans? And I'll just list them without talking about them. Church extension would be more meaningful. Multiple parishes or merger of parishes. We have a seminary at PLTS, Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary. We have a number of colleges. We have outdoor ministries. We could coalesce around Holden Village. Wouldn't that be a marvelous thing? It would be a wonderful thing if we get all of the get a joint convention of this committee to meet in Holden Village and then put them in a sauna where they get so hot they can't resist and make them proposal. You know, it's kind of interesting. The Japanese Evangelical Lutheran Church merger discussions, many of them were held in the hot Japanese baths, and if you've been over there, you know how hot they are. And one of our missionaries, Al Hoagland, said that we used to have some meetings in here, and he said, I think that's why we got along so well as we did, because, you know, when you sit in those extremely hot baths, you don't have any resistance to anything, physical or mental. All right, or a single voice in the ecumenical scene, and that's an absolute necessity, it seems to me, a single voice in the ecumenical scene. These things we could do if we could be together, and many, many more. That's only scraping the surface. Well, I want to stop there. We have about five minutes before coffee. It's at 10, isn't it? It's 5 minutes of 10. I have 5 minutes of 10. Is that right? Okay. We'll try to get a few questions in. Yes.
I would like to say something. You mentioned the Gospel of Christ. And I would like to say specifically to
the
university when he gave a
message.
Talk louder. Talk a little louder.
He gave a message, Dr. Ken Knutson, at the Pacific Lutheran University a few years ago when I was there at a convention. And I taped his message, and I am so thrilled, because his message was on evangelism.
Mm-hmm.
And what left a memory to me mostly was when he said so firmly that what we need is that we each make it our responsibility, it is our responsibility to
go out and teach and to teach. And he had the most marvelous message. You must have it here. Do you?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it probably is.
So maybe some of you have been there.
Yeah.
But I felt that you said that you couldn't understand it. But to me, I'm maybe thinking differently, but I felt that he had done a wonderful work while he was here.
Well, he certainly did.
Well, he didn't say that.
I didn't say that.
No, no, I know he didn't.
No,
say it.
Not by a long shot.
No, but to me, he had finished his work.
Well, that may be.
He had finished his work and left the word that he had given.
Yeah.
And in his messages and tapes.
Yeah, well, that's a valid viewpoint, and I don't dispute it. I only say that I wish God let him live a little bit longer.
Yes.
Carol, you had a point. Well, yeah,
well,
thank you.
I took the tongue of St. Ebgen in the kitchen, and I'd just like to speak to Ebgen a moment, because we who are Norwegian aren't even aware of him, most of us anymore, and there's a blessedness and forgetfulness amongst us always of cruelty to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Ebgen had not written a book. He would have been a first-rate theologian in American society and would have been at Luther Seminary. Unfortunately, he wrote a book before he got to seminary, and proved he was a theologian, and it's difficult for a theologian to get into any seminary, and he can make it, so he had to be friends with Kirky.
You're a cynic, but go ahead.
That's what it's at.
Yeah.
And I know this is why my father pledged me never to write, because he thought maybe I might make it. I didn't anyway. But in going to Kirky, it's interesting that two of the outstanding men we've had from the LCA in theology, coming back to Joel Sittler, whose last book is very readable, you don't have to get a special vocabulary for him, and as well as Jerry, who's dean of the, and has been dean of the faculty at the University of Chicago, both those men are his disciples.
Yeah.
And
right.
Come through from it. And first rate theologian out of East Coming, Michigan, of course, who likes out from Marquette there. But I mean, when I think of my own family, this is my family in Christ, the tragedy we've had in not allowing room for the variance of human response to the scriptural witness.
Yeah.
There's been our sin against each other. And I started to call the Fullness Series, it made a lot of money. We left $46,000 to the new youth department just out of that one series, because again, just like here, everybody wrote for nothing, and some of the books sold very well. But just so that we get theology again, because theology means we trust the man.
Amen.
We may not understand always what he's getting at, but we trust him. He's got a concern.
That's right.
And we're willing to give him time to develop it, and ourselves time to listen. And I wish we could do that in opportunities, because we've had these differences amongst every synod.
Yeah.
Teaching, the great spirit. And unfortunately, there's a feeling between Jack and Teachin, because Jack doesn't have that quality of mind that Teachin does. It isn't given to the Prices to have that quality of mind.
Yeah.
We have an old saying amongst us Norwegians, and it's a good one. We respect and are proud to have the Prices part of our tradition. I love them individually. But we all say it's first the Prices, then it's the church, and then it's God. There can be that tendency when a clan is brilliant as they are.
Yeah, I was going to add one more thing. That, you know, in the Roman Catholic Church, we say, you know, it's a monolithic one structure that always is together. That's not true. They have the genius that we haven't developed, and that is to keep variant viewpoints under one head. They have that brilliant ability to do. That's what we need in the Lutheran Church, is the ability to have widespread viewpoints, but to have it under one overarching responsible. I'm talking about another pope, a Lutheran pope. I'm talking about one Lutheran Church. And to me, it doesn't make a difference the mechanics of how it's run or the hierarchy that's in charge, but the oneness that is there in the Roman Catholic Church. I know I was traveling one time in the old days when planes went more slowly, and I was reading a book. Well, I went up to the restroom, which was in the front end of the plane, and I ran across another person that was dressed clerically, and he said, "Morning, Father." And then I said, when I had taken care of my needs, that I sat down with him, and I said, I'm a Lutheran minister, but does that make any difference? And it seemed to, because he seemed to be a little bit ill at ease. And I was reading Pelikan's book, you know, on the riddle of Roman Catholicism. And I asked him if he'd read it. He said, no, he hadn't yet, but he was intending to. I said, if I didn't have to give a report on it tomorrow, I'd let you have it. But I said, maybe this is oversimplifying, but I've heard it said that the Franciscans say, how can we help you? They're taking after the St. Francis of Assisi. And the Jesuit says, how can I learn from you? And the Dominicans say, how I convert you? How can I convert you? And I said, is that oversimplified? He said, it sure is. We all say, how can we convert you? Well, one more question. Maybe I stopped it by it. All right, there's one back here. Yes.
I have a question, but maybe I will offend someone by saying it. But Dr. Jacob Preuss and also David Preuss are Norwegians. So how did a German Lutheran synod get so lucky to have a Norwegian who is his synod?
Yeah.
So you can all welcome him back someday.
Yeah. See, I'm glad you brought that up and not me, but because I wanted to say one thing to build on that. I hope you, did you all hear what she said?
Yeah.
Okay. There is developing within the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, which, as most of you know, is primarily Germanic, a bitterness against Preuss because he's a Norwegian. And wanting to, how did this foreigner get in here to rile things up? I think that's tragic for two reasons. First, I think it's inhuman to go at it that way. That's one thing. But the second thing is, it's a deviation from what the central problem is. And he's going to become a scapegoat because he's a Norwegian, and too many people that are taking that tack that will not attack the central problem, which is Missouri.
Yes, I yeah. know, but he left 200 sentences before.
Yeah, I know that. What you say is correct. Yeah, I'm not disputing what you say. I'm building on it. Right.
We had fun with that, too, because he wrote it up and said, I left the ELC just in time to save my soul. Yeah. That's the central problem.
Yeah, right. Thank you. Coffee.
Thank you very much.